The J-Talk Podcast.
Yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, after another huge weekend in the top flight, we're a chock full of talking points this week.
Yeah, it was a bit of a crazy weekend. Some weird results, some dreadful refereeing performances. I think J2 might have had it slightly worse if they're bringing IFAB. But yeah, the old jingle, I think, is going to get a good use for this episode.
Yeah, most definitely. So actually, just before I forget, let's just get that out of the way right off the top. This week in VAR. And on a weekend of VAR-tastic action across J1, we could think of no better guest to join us this week to hopefully make some sort of sense of it all than Alan Gibson. Welcome back to the show, Alan. And we couldn't have a better pair of hands to join us this week.
Good afternoon, good evening, good day, wherever you are. And as always, it's a pleasure to be here. It's sad I have to discuss bad refereeing decisions, but hey, we're used to that, aren't we?
Yes, unfortunately, can't argue with you there, Alan. Before we get on to all of that from J1 Matchday 6 action over the weekend, we better first chat about the events of the early morning of Saturday when the World Cup draw was made. And, to say that Japan drew the short straw, Alan, is a bit of an understatement. Japan drawn in a group with Spain, Germany, and either Costa Rica or New Zealand. It was described as one of the groups of death. And coming up against the two recent World Cup winners, it could hardly have been tougher.
I think DAZN and Mikitani conceded together to get Spain in, because Spain against Japan and Iniesta and all the boys there are relevant, and then Germany, well, with bring back Podolski as well, so it's perfect for Vissel Kobe, right? So, but yeah, it's a terrible group, World Cup. This is as they say, there are no easy games in a World Cup either, or there might be when we bring it to 64 teams in the near future. But if Japan can't raise their game against the best in the world, they don't deserve to be there anyway, right? So if they can win a game and draw a game, even get three draws, like I think New Zealand did long ago when they qualified, I don't know, when I was a boy. So, whatever it is, we could always say, well, I wish we'd had Qatar and Serbia, or I don't know. I mean, who are the weak teams? I'm fine for it. 2012, Japan beat Spain at the Olympics. That was a bit of a shock. So, let's go for it. Let's. Of course, I haven't mentioned the fact that Moriyasu might still win a job.
Yes, well, we'll have to wait and see on that front. And of course, Sam, Japan shocked the world in their first group stage game of the 2018 World Cup when they defeated Colombia. So, stranger things have happened. They get to play Germany in their opener. And, who knows what's going to happen there. Obviously, Spain is the last group game, so they might have already qualified by the time that game is played, comes around. So Japan might be able to maybe eke out a result there. And, of course, we've got the Richie Palmer derby to look forward to if the All Whites can get past Costa Rica. So, it's a fascinating group. Just unfortunately, it does look very tough for the Samurai Blue.
Yeah, it's a very tough group, but it's a very exciting group. These are the games you want to be playing, and I'm sure Japan versus Spain against Germany, and I'm not going to rule out either of New Zealand unbeaten at their last World Cup, and Costa Rica, who I've got terrible memories of, topping a group with England, Italy, and Uruguay. So yeah, it's going to be very, very difficult. I'm trying to pick out the positives of the group, and I think, first of all, it fits the system that Moriyasu is going to play. It's going to be, you're going to have to sit in and be really tight, but then press, and then with the players that Japan have got on the counter, if he uses them, they could cause some issues. I think the way that it's set up, Germany, the first game, they have a very, very good international side, but can start tournaments slowly. You could potentially get at them, as Mexico did in the last World Cup. Korea beat them, so you've got to take hope from that. Then you've got that middle game against Costa Rica or New Zealand. So hopefully you win that. You're still in the group going into the last game. And then, if Spain are already qualified, you never know. There's a chance. I'm sure it's not completely over, but it's as difficult a group as you could probably ask for.
Yeah, so we'll wait and see who the Japan manager is and the players that he selects, obviously, for the tournament in November. But, yeah, the path through to the knockout stages is, well, it's laid out in front of Japan. And, obviously, we have all got fingers crossed that they can do the business in November. All right, so let's move on then to events on the pitch in J1 in match day six over the weekend. And, well, there's plenty been happening behind the scenes at the first team we wanted to chat to you about, Alan. That is, of course, Vissel Kobe. We were wondering in the past few weeks when it would be the right time to push the panic button for Vissel after a winless start to the season. Of course, this is match day six, but Kobe have already played eight league fixtures with a couple of their games brought forward with the ACL to kick off the weekend after next. And we can probably get your thoughts about that before we let you go as well. But I think eight games without a win in the top flight is it's not quite time to push the panic button. I think everybody's already smashed it to smithereens, Alan.
Yeah, it's dire what's going on at Vissel Kobe, isn't it? It's ironic that Mikitani actually finally gave a manager some time and a bit of patience, but I'm not sure it was the right manager. I mean, Atsu Mura was basically a chief scout or general manager who just got the job for a few games and managed to, I think, stop the rot at that time and kept the job. And I'm sure that... I don't know what to say. I think that Vissel Kobe put all their eggs in the one basket at the start of the season and decided we've got to save our players for the ACL. It's noticeable that Vissel Kobe players have been pulling out of 50-50 challenges for me, yet still they've got half a team injured. I'm surprised that Iniesta even played at the weekend because, they really want to do so well in the ACL, I think. And now that they've done that to the detriment of the league, people might say, all excuses. People can play in the cup and the league, and it happens in Europe as well. But I think the fact that I could literally see players not giving their all in these games and the rotation of some of the players too. And they started off badly. Kikuchi was injured for two or three games at the start too. They've got two goalkeepers who Toshi Coin, and both of them are prone to errors, and now they've Muto looked very good, and Osako came in, and they actually looked as if they'd made some reasonable decisions on who to sign for a change. And then Muto's out for the ACL. He's at least another month before he comes back, and Samper's out for the season as well. So it never rains but it pours, and I'm not sure a change of a manager, especially a manager who was in J3 until last year and got fired or released from that team, FC Imabari, just happened to be in Japan with a working visa and got a job teaching the kids at Vissel Kobe, to put it simply. And then it suddenly he's like, oh, would you mind managing our team for a bit? Because apparently he's been noted as interim manager. So I really don't know what to say there. I mean, we've seen it coming. And those of us who've watched Vissel Kobe for 20 years or more have seen the changes that Mr. Mikitani likes to do. As I said, ironically, he actually gave Mura a chance, and it's all fallen flat. What do you think, Sam?
I was just going to ask you, do you know, is there a plan, or what is that plan, if there is one? Like, I saw an interim manager and I thought, okay, ACL's coming up. Is he just there until the ACL you want to, and then they want a permanent manager in to take that group stage? Or is he just, we'll see how he does and then we'll panic and change later on when it all goes wrong?
I'm really not sure. I mean, the sad fact is, and it's one of the lesser problems that coronavirus has caused, but people like me, who are very fortunate to have access to players and managers and staff, usually have not been able to approach players directly for managers or even, staff people for 2 years now, for want of them staying in their own little bubble and match days. And so I've got a few people who tell me things off the record now and again, but they don't really know what's going on either. So I get the feeling that I happen to know a particular manager who would like to do the job and has been very successful in the past. But basically, he has stated that he wants to run the team, run the club from the bottom up. And I don't think that's the kind of thing that Mikitani wants. And if he wants to stay in control of his little, you know, one of his toys, then he's not going to give a decent manager the job anyway. So I'm a bit concerned that in the end we'll just sign another Spaniard, bring in another Spanish manager, a couple of assistants, and in 2 years Iniesta will be managing the team without any qualifications whatsoever. So to cut a long story short there, Sam, I don't think there is a plan. This guy just happened to be there at the time. We're heading for the ACL. Literally, they'll be leaving next week after the weekend, I think. And there's six games to play. Hopefully, even with half a team and not a lot going on, they'll raise their game enough because this is what they've been aiming for. It's obvious. And hopefully they can at least get out of the group stage, and then maybe they can turn things around and get out of the bottom two in the league, because you know the old saying, they're too good to go down.
Yes, well, that's what we'd, I guess we'd be hanging our hats on, Alan. But yeah, after they've played almost a quarter of their top flight fixtures this year, they are, of course, still without a win, and just four draws and 4 points to their name from their eight league games so far. They took the lead in the Kansai Derby at home against Kyoto on Saturday through Ryo Hatsusei's first J1 goal 4 minutes into the second half. Shortly afterwards, Ryuho Kikuchi, his header from a corner was tipped over by Naoto Kami Fukumoto. But then, I guess, the first of our VAR talking points from the weekend, Sam, and Kobe could feel very hard done to here by the looks of things. No offside given as Takuya Ogiwara scored his first J1 goal in the 55th minute, volleying in from inside the 6-yard box after Daiki Kaneko's cross was deflected. But it did appear to pretty much all and sundry, except the DAZN commentary team and the refereeing crew, including the VAR team, that there was an offside in the build-up.
I mean, this was baffling because as Kaneko gets the ball, Ogiwara gets the ball and then Kaneko makes the run outside of him, it's clear that he delays the pass. So he's obviously run out offside. And then he plays the ball. I mean, it's quite clear on the replay that he's definitely offside. It looks so obvious live. I just tweeted when I saw it's going to be offside. I was in no doubt. But as with every decision in these things, maybe I've misconstrued the lines and whatnot, and maybe I've not seen it the way that the VAR sees it. But there is no way of watching that and determining that he was onside. It is a clear and obvious error. I don't understand why it's not been overturned. And, I mean, it turned the game as well. And not that Kyoto were playing poorly. They had the ascendancy and this completely turned it, and yeah, Kyoto went on from this point on and took full advantage of the kind of luck that they were given. But yeah, it was a terrible decision, and maybe it's just one of those things when things are going against you, as they are for Vissel Kobe.
Alan, I mean, we've got you on to talk about some of the more contentious decisions and refereeing points from across the weekend, but I don't think there can be too much argument from anybody here, and I don't know if you can give us any sort of a better explanation than Sam's tried to offer there. This just appeared to be a mistake by all concerned, and I guess we just have to wonder again whether this is just an example of VAR not wanting to show up the on-field refereeing team, because this just appeared to be a clear and obvious error.
I really don't know what to say either. I think I mentioned it at the time on Twitter or whatever. I actually got the video that was going around on social media, and then I also got the freeze frame. And as I walked out of the ground, or rather out of the stand, on the 95 minutes or whatever it was, I walked past the match commissioner and the referee instructors, for want of a better word, who I know. They're my senpais. From the Hyogo and Kansai Football Association, and I just showed them the video and the still, and of course in the true Japanese style, they were like, they shrugged their shoulders and smiled to each other and put their hands up in the air as if to say, I don't know what to say, you know. And this is a problem that I think we've discussed, and myself in particular has been quite vocal on since the podcast began, is that, if I may digress, the commentary team in Japan is there to talk about, well, anything except the game. I mean, the fact that I couldn't believe it. I had to listen again and play it to myself again and listen carefully. There was absolutely no mention at all, as far as I can tell, of the possibility of offside, the possibility of it being discussed or looked at, was not even mentioned. Imagine in England or Italy or most places in the world where someone who's not too worried about upsetting someone's feelings, you'll get that replayed 20,000 times with lines drawn across the pitch, and then the referee abused and his address given out to everybody in the stadium probably. So I think that is, as we've said before time and again, the problem is that Japanese football will not learn if the commentators do not highlight these things. Literally 15 or 20 years ago, I was talking to people, including actually Hiromi Hara, who is now on the J-League judge replay thing, about having some kind of show or highlight suggesting what might have gone wrong in J-League games. And I told them that they should use me because I know what I'm talking about, but also I'm the gaijin and they can blame me for upsetting everybody. And it's sort of, I mentioned it to quite a few people in the J-League at the time, sort of half joking, but really I just wanted to. And then when the J-League replay came along, I was really happy. But they don't really do much, do they? The fact is that they do highlight a few errors now and again, but once the J-League replay show, the J-League judgment show perhaps gets a bit more teeth into it, and then they can advise that the commentators may be allowed to say something, things might change. But for now, I think the commentators, and as you said, the VAR officials are perhaps worried about their senpais being upset with them. So I just don't know what to say. I was speechless, but more to the fact that commentators completely ignored it, and I was very upset about that.
Yep, so Kobe was stung by that equaliser that, really should not have stood. And then just 3 minutes after that, Takumi Miyayoshi blasted in after Hiroki Ikura failed to catch a cross in from the left from Ogiwara, who was having a terrific afternoon. So 2-1 to Kyoto, and Fuki Yamada put the icing on the cake on, an afternoon of firsts at the Noivir Stadium. Hatsuse and Ogiwara before him had scored their first J1 goals, and Yamada got into the act in the 94th minute when he volleyed in Tenma Matsuda's cross from the left. So not taking anything away from Kyoto, Sam, we don't want to do that, of course. They've made their return to the top flight after a long spell in the doldrums in J2. And, this is a terrific victory for them and all of their supporters. And, a thoroughly deserved one, I think, on the run of play from the highlights. Anyway, obviously, Kobe had hard lines with the equaliser. But, Kyoto, I don't think any of their goals were particularly, end-to-end beautiful football. But they took their opportunities when they presented themselves.
Oh, they did. I thought they played very well. And coming into this game, they had 8 players that had contracted COVID over the previous week or so. So I don't think it affected their first team quite as much as it did to Shonan, that we'll get onto later. But they definitely had various players missing, had to change their goalkeeper back. It got Kami Fukumoto back into the side, and there were various other ones. But I thought they played really well. They first started, Kobe had a lot of possession. It's just kind of very typical Vissel Kobe, is that they have a lot of the ball without looking particularly dangerous. While Kyoto, on the counter-attack, they looked the more threatening, they looked the more decisive. I thought Utaka, the way he was just dropping off the centre-backs, they weren't being able to pick him up, and he was causing so many problems there at the start of attacks rather than him necessarily being the focal point of them. And they just couldn't get to grips with him. The movement of him was very good. I mean, they brought in Matsudu, who I thought played very well with his movement. And Kaneko came on as a substitute quite early. I think Takatomi went off injured, and he was pulling the strings. So I really liked the performance from Kyoto, just sitting back, soaking up the pressure, but then they were really dangerous on the counter-attack. And it was just one where Vissel kind of go back to just Vissel at their worst, where they just plod along. They've got a lot of the ball. It looks like they should really be in control of the game, but just, no end product. They kind of switched their formation up. They played Hatsuse, the previously left back, as playing right wing. It was a little bit all over the place. Yeah, he got his goal through some pretty dodgy defending from Kyoto, but otherwise they didn't really look too threatening, Kobe, although obviously they have that real gripe having conceded an offside goal just after they'd really got themselves into the game and taken control.
Yes, indeed. All right, then. So, Alan, yeah, two games left in the league for Kobe before they head off to the ACL. And, yeah, obviously two more chances to get a first victory of the season. But they have to travel to FC Tokyo on Wednesday night, and then they're at home for another Kansai derby against Cerezo Osaka on Sunday. So they'll be tricky. And obviously, if they fail to win both of those games, that'll be 10 without a win to start the season. But again, you suggesting they've had more than one eye on the ACL since the start of this campaign. So by the sound of it, they just can't wait to get over to Thailand and get this group stage played.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what happens if they can sort of, well, win the first game or two and relax a little and come back with four or five wins, but most importantly, at least qualification. They can come back and relax a bit more. I get the feeling that there'll be more changes for the players that are left. I know of at least five or six injuries that they have. But there'll be two more games where I think that their eyes will still be on the ACL, and they'll be lucky to get a point even, because, I did notice, interesting, Sam, I don't know what you think about it, but Vissel Kobe rarely, if ever, took one of those short goal kicks in this game, where they play around with like two defenders in the box and pass it around about six times. At least they were getting it out to Hatsuse and Sakai on the wings and playing a lot more direct than usual, but they didn't quite, you know, do anything at the top end of the pitch. But I wonder if that was the manager or a necessity of playing. I think in the end they were playing with six defenders in the team, because Osaki, Leo, Hatsuse and Sakai were all playing midfield, but basically they're defenders as well. And they're playing three at the back, so six defenders. But ironically, they weren't passing it around at the back. They were getting it up fast, but they just didn't do anything with it. So, you know, there seemed to be some kind of change going on, but it wasn't very effective. Two more games of possibly nothing, or a couple of draws if they're lucky. The ACL will be the change, literally 3 weeks of see what happens. If they come back unqualified from the ACL, their season's a disaster. The confidence will be shot, what's left of it anyway. And they'll be under real pressure to survive relegation.
Yeah, just on that, with the no passing out from the back, I think a lot of that is to do with Kyoto. Because they really do press high. They don't allow teams to do that. Yes, and there are more defensive players in the team. They didn't really have like a Samper who would drop back and be that sort of player that would take the ball from the edge of the area and build up. So, yeah, they were firing it kind of a little bit more direct to the more offensive players, the better passes of the ball. And it was just around the area. They were just kind of not really decisive enough with their passing, just passing it around, and yeah, it just didn't work. And you mentioned there obviously the focus on the ACL, and I've been quite vocal in saying that I don't agree with that. I don't believe that is happening. And you've played eight games, Kobe played eight games, the ACL isn't starting till April. You've got plenty of time to focus on the league, and the ACL is its own entity in a bubble. You've got to go play those games. It's not like you've got midweek games to focus on, and you've got a trip to Australia to come up, and that's where you might be focusing more on the ACL. So I don't get it as a and if it is happening, I just don't accept that it should be allowed to happen. So what is the feeling among the average Vissel Kobe supporter if they do believe that the team are phoning it in the league and focusing on the ACL? Are they accepting of that and think, okay, if we do well in the ACL, it'll all be worth it? Or is there a growing frustration that a team that has got such a big wage, but it should be challenging for the league, is currently in the doldrums, second from bottom?
Well, sadly, again, the Japanese way is not to, not very often is teams will boo and, you know, well, we're not allowed to boo or shout at the team at the moment, are they? What was quite amusing, I think it was not the last game I went to, but the game before, whichever one that was, Vissel Kobe home game, the players sort of go to their fans and wave at them. And there's one, just literally one guy I saw who was walking along the stand with his two thumbs down and then making a cross sign, you know, a batsu. And then, you know, obviously there was like, I don't know how many, 300, 400, 500, 600 people were clapping and smiling and, you know, trying to get pictures or whatever. And there was this one guy who was following the players along the stand with his thumbs going down. And he really wanted to shout and boo. I could see that. But he was doing as he was told. But he was really working hard to put his thumbs down. And sadly, I think it's a minority at the moment. I think You know, these people are blinded. A lot of the fans are blinded by the stars on the field and the fact that they are in the ACL. And so, yeah, I think basically it's being accepted at the moment. But, yeah, if they don't come back with a victorious ACL, then all hell's going to break loose, especially if J-League decide that the fans can open their mouths as well.
Yeah, well, it's been just a horrific start to the league campaign. I mean, there's no use mincing our words any other way. But if they can do the business in the Champions League and get into the latter stages of that, then they just have to hope there's a knock-on effect of positive results in the league as well. But yeah, it's a very difficult start to the campaign for Vissel. But again, full credit to Kyoto for a terrific victory. And thoroughly deserved, and they're well and truly entrenched in mid-table after six match days. Next, we'll move on to the two Osaka clubs who enjoyed terrific results themselves in match day six. Gamba Osaka claimed a 3-1 home victory over Nagoya. And Alan, right off the top, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the changes that Mr. Katon Osaka made to the starting 11. The Brazilian midfielder Dawa was straight into the first team after I think that was his debut for Gamba, definitely his first start. Hiroto Yamami, the exciting young forward, was starting up in the front line, and in goal, Jun Ichimori made the start with the previously incumbent Kei Ishikawa. Of course, they're definitely just a replacement for Masaki Higashiguchi, but he had started all of the league games so far. It was dropped back to the bench. So, some interesting maneuvers there from Katon Osaka as he shook things up. And I think, he's been vindicated. It was an excellent performance by Gamba, and most importantly, they turned it into a thoroughly deserved 3-1 victory.
Yeah, interesting. I think possibly that some of the changes were forced upon him, or the fact that some of the players that had been playing were not necessarily the ones he wanted. I think Yuki Yamamoto is missing without leave, and I'm not sure what's happened to him, but he's a great little player in the middle. I've heard nothing about an injury, but these things happen, and you know, COVID and whatever. So, but I think the interesting one was the goalkeeper Ichimori. I believe, talking to some other fans who know better, that Ichimori was actually basically the second reserve goalkeeper, but has been injured for a while. And of course, nobody thought he was ever going to play anyway, because Higashiguchi didn't miss a game for like 20 years or something. So I think that Ichimori finally came in for Ishikawa, because he is actually the reserve, but Ishikawa hadn't covered himself in glory, but none of the Gamba players had really. Kurokawa came out and scored, was it his first goal? But he scored a great goal and did very well there. Mitsuki Saito was looking very good in the middle there. And I think Yamami would probably have been eased in, coming on after about 75 minutes in replace of Usami for 6 or 7 games. But unfortunately, Usami's out for the season. Gamba's mounting injury problems have not helped, of course. Yamami is one of those players that, Mr. Moriyasu would keep on the bench for sure, for example. He was given a chance last season 2 or 3 times. He scored that amazing goal against S-Pulse after being on the field for about 5 minutes. And announced himself, "I'm here." I think Leandro Pereira really should be the starting forward with Usami. But of course, Usami's gone, and Pereira's been injured and in and out of the team for a year already. And I just don't think he's fit. And even now he was on the bench. So Patrick, who I believe was going to be a reserve for the whole of last year, pretty much played every other game at least. So, I mean, they're really struggling to put a consistent team together. So who knows what will happen next time when they but these players, all 11 of them played rather well, I think. Takao was carried off the pitch near the end. Some said it was cramp because one of the players was, helping him with a cramp type of thing, but he was also holding his thighs, so I'm not sure about that. But, Katano Zaka has got his system, but he's not been able to really play it so much. I think he prefers 3 at the back. And with players like Kurokawa, Onose, Fujiharu, who's been absent but apparently is ready at the left back and the left wing back, and he's got Yuya Fukuda also plays left back or right back or left wing or right wing. He's got plenty of choice, but he's stuck into the guys he knows right now. And, you know, apart from Dawan, who came in, I didn't really see enough of him to be convinced, because everyone around him was playing rather well, I think. So it'll be interesting to see if he manages to stay on, because he's only 23. So one of the younger Brazilians, as opposed to the journeymen that we often get in the J League. So obviously, well, a winning mentality breeds confidence and a bit of momentum going into the next game. Gamba, they looked very good. I mean, it should be noted that Nagoya Grampus were missing both of their first choice centre backs for a start. Maruyama, who's been out about 8 months and is apparently quite close to return, and was on the bench this game actually. And Nakatani, who was rumoured to have COVID, they did announce a player had COVID at the same time that Japan national team announced the player had COVID, and Nakatani disappeared. So we have to presume that he's gone. So you know, missing the key part of their defence helped Gamba, perhaps. But as you will no doubt say, you can't take it away from Gamba. They scored three wonderful goals and they got 3 points, and hopefully they can go on from there.
Indeed. Well, I mean, the second goal was a bit lucky, wasn't it? But Sam, yeah, Yamami, who we've talked about, and obviously, yeah, burst into the scene, as Alan's referenced again there, with that terrific goal against Shimizu last year. He played his part in both of the first two goals, sending in a free kick from deep on the right in the 26th minute to Gen Shoji's low drive. As a result of that, from just inside the box, was diverted past Mitch Langerak by Patrick. Langerak then made a terrific save to keep out Patrick's header. And up the other end, Ichimori made a courageous save at the feet of Noriyoshi Sakai just before the end of the first 45. But then, yeah, a crazy own goal, wasn't it, in the 54th minute, when the Yamami crossed from the right and the Mateus tried to hoof the ball clear, but it struck Kazuya Miyahara and flew in past a helpless Langerak. So I guess, your mummy's cross was half decent, but it was just one of those where I guess Grandpa supporters knew it wasn't going to be their day when something like that's happening to you.
Captain Tsubasa.
Yeah. It was a good cross from Yamami, but it was just the Nagoya defence are at sixes and sevens. I mean, Fuji and Thiago were playing together. I don't think the communication was great between them, so they were all over the place. And Miyahara and Mateus both noticed that there was a position they had to fill, kind of both decided to fill it at the same time, got in each other's way, complete kerfuffle. Mateus clears it off Miyahara and in. Yeah, it's a woeful own goal to concede, but it was just a part of the whole defence was so all over the place. I mean, you'd never see it last season or the season before with Ficadente. But yeah, with that, I think Morishita was playing left back, so you've got no Yoshida as well. So that really stable defence had been completely torn apart, and they were all over the place. Gamba, I thought, played very well to take advantage of that. I thought the movement in that front three was very dynamic. I thought Mitsuki Saito has just grown and grown in this season. The way that he's a terrier in out of possession, he wins the ball back, but when he's got it, he's just another player that can just see a pass, and he played a few in this game that really caused Nagoya problems. So if he's allowed a little bit more license, if Dawan is going to come in next to him and be more of that holding midfielder, then they've got a fantastic looking midfield there, I think, because you've got Nagoya's midfield with Inagaki and Leo Silva and Sento. It looks a really strong one, but Gamba completely dominated in that area, and that allowed them to get at the weakened defence. And yeah, I thought it was Gamba's best performance since 2020.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so a great result for Gamba. It takes them up to ninth, a first win in four games, their second of the season. For Nagoya, things are definitely not clicking. Of course, they've only played the five league games, as have FC Tokyo, after their match day two fixture was postponed. But they find themselves down in 14th in the early going. There's a question on them from Graham Freche. Sam, I'll come back to you with this one. Graham Fredger says the chances are there for Grampus, but the goals aren't. What do you think about the idea of trying to get Everaldo from Kashima. He's obviously stuck behind Yuma Suzuki and ISA Wada in the pecking order there at the moment. Graham Freche says they don't use him, and Grampus definitely need a striker, and he could find back his form in Nagoya. Does that sound like a reasonable proposition to you?
Maybe it would have done. Unfortunately, Everaldo's back in Brazil with an adductor injury, so he won't be fit. I think the deadline, is it today, the deadline, or has it already passed? But yeah, I don't think anyone can make a signing now except for loan developmental deals, like loan deals down into J2. So I think they're stuck with what they've got at the moment. They're just going to have to hope that Sveshok is let off and allowed to come and play again. But yeah, theoretically, it would have been a decent option if you can get the Everaldo from a couple of years ago. But yeah, unfortunately, that ship has sailed. So they are stuck with what they have. You mentioned the Sakai shot that it was well saved by Ichimura. They had another decent effort where Sakai played in Sento over the top, but he just volleyed it the first time rather than taking it down. And so, yeah, they are just snatching at their chances a little bit. And yeah, it's just going to be a running theme, I think, for this season until maybe they get to the summer and look into it. But yeah, there are definitely going to be strikers around. Let's hope for some good scouting. They definitely had the good scouting when they got Sveshok. It's a pity he decided to take a banned substance. But yeah, you can look around. There's bound to be players there. You don't always have to rehash previous J-League players either. I think there is definitely more out there. And yeah, I think we've got past the stage of signing Kenyans because Olunga was good, so that's better. But yeah, there's definitely going to be someone in there, and they have to look for it because it is a clear weakness for Nagoya. And even on games where they might be on top, they're not being able to see off other teams with the lack of clinical nature of their strikers.
Yeah, no, fair enough. So from 2-0, yeah, Alan's mentioned Keisuke Kurokawa's excellent goal for his first J1 tally. That came just past the hour to make it 3-0 to Gumba. And then Keiya Sento, who spurned that earlier chance. He caught the Jusejong dawdling on the ball just outside the Gumba box and fired past Ichimori in the 83rd minute, while the Gumba keeper had to make a leaping save to keep out Haruya Fuji's Rasper in stoppage time. But yes, Gumba ultimately saw out a deserved victory, and credit to them. Probably the biggest shock of the match day six slate came at Todoroki, where defending champions Kawasaki suffered their second defeat of this season. And to put it bluntly, they were absolutely hammered by Cerezo Osaka, Alan. I don't think any of us saw this coming, but a brace apiece from Takashi Inui and Hiroto Yamada. And, happy days for the pink half of Osaka.
They just seemed to click, didn't they? I mean, all over the field, they looked excellent. I'm not sure the fact that Matejonic returned to the defence really made much difference, because it was going forward and the terrible holes in the opposition defence that really turned the game. But people like Harakawa and Okuno and Nakahara were making the passes, and Inui and Yamada were finishing. I think Yosuke Yamanaka, who came from Urawa Reds for the left-back position, has now taken over from Marahashi. I think you had me on just before the season started, actually, when I said that both of the Cerezo fullbacks were probably going to be replaced eventually, and I think Yamanaka has now taken over from Marahashi. Matsuda has got a new lease of life, though. We've got Seiya Maikuma on the bench from Fuivara and Nagasaki last year, but Matsuda seems to have risen to the occasion and is just doing a bit better, so he might have to wait a bit longer, Seiya Maikuma. But Yonich and Nishio, goes from the past there, Nishio. Yonich and Nishio at centre-backs were very solid. They didn't seem to have that much to do. And Harakawa was spraying it out nicely. I mean, everything just seemed to click, right? I mean, I don't think we're going to see Kawasaki Frontale have a bad day like that again. And I think it was just a one-off. Hopefully, Cerezo will grow from it and, you know, they'll keep scoring goals. And we could all say, hopefully, Cerezo Frontale are done, but they're not, are they? They'll just bounce back from this. But yeah, it was a bit of a shocker, but a pleasant one for most of the teams in J1, I think.
Yeah, a really, yeah, an interesting result. Obviously, it set the cat amongst the pigeons. We'd spoken before the international break about, yeah, Frontale somehow without playing all that well, apparently, Sam, they'd gone 4 points clear at the top. And, well, yeah, they've been well and truly pegged back after match day six with their defeat. And then F. Marino's Kashima and Kashiwa all winning to close the gap at the top. But, yeah, a first half of Cerezo's dreams, basically, wasn't it? Inui scored in the 13th minute after Yamada's shot was deflected onto the post. Then in the 28th minute, Inui ran on to Nakahara's through ball and finished past Junsung Ryong. They were well and truly in dreamland, Cerezo supporters, after Yamada poked past Taniguchi just inside the Kawasaki half and raced to clear before finishing past Jung in the 36th minute. And then at halftime, Sam, Toru Uniki reacted by making four subs. But Cerezo went four goals up in the 68th minute when Harakawa squared for Yamada to finish his brace. So was it just simply one of those afternoons for Kawasaki that obviously most teams have every now and then? They just don't seem to ever have them themselves.
Well, it's definitely one of those afternoons. And I mean, everyone could thank themselves lucky, the ones that didn't get subbed at half time, because I think if Oniki had his way, he would have changed all 11. And Shogo Taniguchi is very fortunate that he managed to stay on, because he had perhaps the worst performance I've ever seen from him in that first half, especially. He was at fault at least for the first and the third goal. It was just a little bit all over the place. And maybe he's just tired of having to anchor this defence as everyone else falls around him and there's no defenders brought in. But yeah, he was absolutely all over the place. Just they hounded him, they stole the ball off him high. Yamada just nicked it away from him on halfway for the third goal. He lost possession as well for the first one. It was just, he was a little, well, completely all over the place. Kawasaki, as a result, they really rely on him to keep that together. With Sasaki, the young left-back, Yamamura, who's not really a centre-back, but he's done okay there. But it just, everything fell apart for them. And Cerezo, I thought, were magnificent. Nakahara, I just really like everything about Nakahara, the way he just slips in those little passes. Inui made those clever runs in from out wide into there. And then Yamada, who is always a player that had promise but has never really shown too much, but he looks like he's growing this season, and he scored two very well taken goals in this game. And it was just everything that could have gone right did go right for Cerezo, and the complete opposite for Frontale. And yeah, let's see how they bounce back in midweek, and I don't think I'd want to be Jubilo Iwata.
No, most definitely. Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating subplot on Wednesday night to see how the champions respond. But yeah, I imagine the hairdryer treatment would have been in full effect. But well, not only at halftime, but definitely at full time as well from Toru Uniki. And yeah, so again, we don't want to take anything away from Cerezo, who took their chances and yeah, thoroughly deserved their victory. And yeah, there were some clamors for us to get Neil Debnam on, but we didn't want to ambush Neil after a result like that. We'll just wait and see how midweek goes before checking if Neil wants to join us maybe on next week's episode for a state of play at Todoroki. But yeah, he will have been shaken, I'm sure, by that result as well. But all right, so yeah, overall, Kobe excluded, it was a very, very fruitful match day six for the Kansai clubs. Of course, two of them facing off at the Noriva Stadium, and Kyoto well and truly claiming the honours there. Okay, so before we let you go, Alan, we did want to check, apart from the Kyoto equaliser in the Kobe game, the other two games we've discussed didn't have too many VAR incidents, but the one big one from J1 we wanted to get your thoughts on came at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, where Antlers hosted Shimizu. And this kicked off with the score at 0-0 in this game. It involved Diego Pachuca. Firstly, him getting booked after a stoush with Benjamin Kalole in the 54th minute, but ultimately that wasn't related to his sending off, though I think that, you know, began his, maybe his blood boiling, I'm not sure. But Pachuca was subbed off in the 64th minute. And as he was leaving the pitch, as he had just left the pitch, kicked a PET bottle on the side of the pitch, and that actually flew into the stands. You could see it on the replay from one of the angles. It actually did hit the railing in front of some spectators. So something that Pachuca definitely should not have been doing, and the referee produced a red card. I guess the concern we have, the questions we have, is over whether Antlers should have actually been able to allow their substitute to continue to take part in the game, or whether once he's actually left the pitch and his replacement has come on, that means that they can still remain with 11 players on the pitch.
That's right. Yeah, it was interesting. I think you could see that the referee, with his little hand on his ear and his hand held out in front of him as if he was doing some kind of little disco dance, he was actually talking to the VAR to make sure that Ueda had entered the field, I think, or more importantly, that Pituca had left the field when the incident took place, which of course was obvious if you had a quick look, because the bottle was off the field. I think the fact that, I don't know, you know, we've said it before perhaps, but because it was a foreign player, they sort of highlighted it and showed replays from all angles to make sure that we saw the bottle go into the crowd there. And Kashima Antlers have already actually put out a statement saying that our player did the wrong thing and we will take steps to educate him, which is quite amusing but necessary, I suppose. Hopefully it'll pass away. The guy, you know, if it hadn't gone into the crowd, it would probably have been okay, but the fact that it sort of went up in the air and almost hit someone, or perhaps got somebody a bit wet, will probably blow it out of a bit more out of proportion. But yeah, back to the original point. I think the key was that Pituca had left the field. The sign had gone up saying who was replacing him. And I think actually Ueda had stepped onto the field when the referee or the fourth official actually told him to go off the field again and wait. And then they discussed whether that the substitution had been made or not. And I think the fact that they knew that the substitution had been made, they knew that Ueda was on the pitch or that Pituca was off the pitch. And I get the feeling that they were just discussing the rules and the laws between themselves to say, is it okay if I let him go on, you know? And I think they got this one right, as opposed to something that happened in J2, which you might talk about later if you want. Ueda was legally allowed to enter the field because Pituca had left the field, in my opinion, and they can carry on with 11 players, yeah.
That all sounds all right. It's just the kind of the grey area that I was thinking as it was happening was the game hasn't restarted, so has that substitution taken effect? That was kind of the confusion that I had, and I'm sure it was kind of what was being discussed by the officials. But if you say, yeah, it's just as soon as the player has left the pitch and the replacement has come on, that's absolutely fine. But yeah, it was just a very weird one and a bit of a kind of grey area that you don't really see very often.
Correct. I think they did the right thing in the end. And as I said, I'm not sure that they, I think they knew the procedure of what had happened. And I think they were probably discussing the rules amongst themselves. And I think that they got it right. We haven't heard anything different yet. So hopefully it was all good.
All right. I'll tell you what, we'll come back to the goal scorers and the events in that game. Before we let you go, Alan, let's just do the handball and the non-awarding of a penalty in the Sapporo-Urawa game. Sapporo felt very hard done to, and I felt with some justification there, especially after they had conceded a penalty in similar circumstances in the 26th minute. That was finally confirmed after a lengthy VAR delay. Akito Fukumori sliding in with his arm raised and Mawatari's cross hitting said arm, and the referee pointing to the spot. Finally, yeah, they needed three or four minutes to confirm that correct decision had been made. And then, 7 minutes after Moberg had given Reds the lead, Takuro Kaneko shot from the edge of the box, and that shot struck the arm of Ken Iwao. But again, to the protestations of the Sapporo players, they were denied a penalty, and they felt, as I said, hard done to. And please shed some light on that, because Sam and I have struggled with the silhouette and all that kind of stuff over the past couple of years. So what was your thoughts on that non-awarding of a penalty to Consadole?
I think that both of the handballs were accidental. but that doesn't make any difference anymore these days. According to the current laws, Fukumori's arm was up there and it was an obvious penalty according to the laws. I think originally that the referee had given it just outside the area, so that had to be discussed. But in the end, that was a correct decision according to the laws. And I think that going back to the actual changing of the laws, I think that gaining advantage from a hand that is way out from the body or the silhouette there, I think I'd agree with the law there as well, that the fact is that that ball could have gone into a goal scoring position, you know. But yep, according to the law, that was a penalty kick. Then we see Ken Iwao, and I haven't really looked at it over and over again, but my first impression was, again, according to the law, the ball hit part of his body first, then bounced onto his hand. If Sam or you have watched it more and more, then please correct me, but I think that that's what's happened. I didn't really I've had to look on my iPhone, shall we say, the screen's not that big, so my initial thought was it's not a PK according to the law, because it bounced off another part of his body onto his arm. But to me, again, the arm was out there and the ball was going perhaps towards another player. I don't see the difference in them myself, and I think they should all be given. But what we're dealing with here is the laws of the game, and the law of the game states that if the ball comes off another part of the body and hits your hand, then it's not given. So that's my thought on that one.
Okay, well, my thought on it is, first of all, the Fukumori one, his hand is going up, he's raising it, he's moving it away from his body, so it blocks the cross coming in, it goes out of that silhouette, as they say, and I think that's definitely a handball. I think they were just, the check was just whether it was inside the area or not. And I agree with the referee on the Sapporo one. I'm just watching it again now. I don't think it's comes off the body at all. I think his arm is out as it starts, and he's bringing it back into the silhouette, which I think is the key difference between this one. One is moving it away, making himself bigger. This one, he's actively trying to get him get his arm in by his side, and both are at quite close to their quarters. So I think it's fair that this isn't given as a penalty. I completely get the frustration from Sapporo supporters, and Misha Petrić throughout the entire game was getting angrier and angrier, and it was just boiling over by the end of it. But I think, from what I understand of the rules, I think Fukumori is making himself bigger while Iwao is trying to make himself smaller, and that is the distinction that the VAR has gone with these two handball decisions.
I think we are in agreement, perhaps for slightly different reasons. I'll have a closer look myself when you cut me off here. But yeah, I think the referee the VAR was right in the end on both counts. Yes.
Yep. Okay then. All right. So yeah, there are a couple of odd VAR things here or there that we could trouble you with, Alan. But for now, yeah, we'll leave it there. The three Kansai, the four Kansai clubs, and indeed, yeah, we wanted to get your thoughts on the Pachuca, the red card for Antlers. So yeah, we'll leave it there. Thanks ever so much for joining us this week, and yeah, we look forward to catching up with you again.
Pleasure was all yours.
All right, welcome back, and thanks again to Alan. We got a little bit jumpy going here and there all over the place at the end of part one there, Sam, but wanted to get some of Alan's thoughts on a couple of the big refereeing decisions from the weekend. So we'll head back to Kashima and talk about their huge 2-1 home win over Espal. So after Pachuca was sent off, but of course Antlers didn't go a man down in the 64th minute, Benjamin Kalole, who had that earlier run-in with Pachuca, headed Espal's into a 70th minute lead, but Yuma Suzuki, who was never out of the headlines or never out of the major incidents in a particular game that he's playing in, headed in an equaliser in the 78th minute, and then laid on the winner in stoppage time with a lovely cross that ISA Wada met with a terrific glancing header in off Shuichi Gonda's right hand post. So what could turn out to be a vital victory for Antlers, but a heartbreak for Espal at the death.
Oh, very much so, because they must have thought they'd got away with a point, and it would have been got away with one as well. I mean, Kashima, I thought, were the better side for the majority of this game, although Shimizu did take the lead, and I'm happy for Kaloli to finally get one, because he's had a lot of chances, really, and it's not really fallen for him, and it's not really quite gone his way, and he got the deflection here, and he got his goal, so maybe he can go on a run now. But yeah, Kashima, I thought, responded very well. They'd already had a goal disallowed right at the start of the second half. No controversy about this. Suzuki was definitely offside. But yeah, they then bounced back from, well, Pituka's incident and whatnot. And yeah, it was the Yuma Suzuki show. He's involved in absolutely everything. I think he is the most hated man in the J-League. I mean, our line group is not a fan of Yuma Suzuki, as I found out earlier. And I think that's generally the way it is. But we'll forget whatever he might do, and kind of his personality, he is a tremendous footballer, and he was involved in everything that was good about them going forward. The header is perfect past Shuichi Gondo. He gets a little bit of fingertip to it, can't keep it out, and then he has the guile as well with that cross in for Ueda. It's a perfect ball in and a really good header as well, again from Ueda this time. But yeah, it was just Yuma Suzuki. He can do absolutely everything. I still want him in the Japan national team, but I think there is absolutely no way that Moriyasu thinks I want to manage Yuma Suzuki. So I think I'll have to put that one to bed. But it was a tremendous performance. And when you can harness Suzuki, and he's got something that he's really interested into the game, and he wants to play, and he's got something to prove, I think there's no better striker in the league.
Yeah, fantastic. A fourth consecutive victory for Kashima. And, yep, quite a partnership they're forming up front, Suzuki and Ueda. And, yep, look out the rest of J1, because, yeah, once they properly hit their straps, then, yeah, the sky will definitely be the limit for Antlers. Also, 2-1 home winners on Saturday were Yokohama F. Marinos, this time over FC Tokyo, who, of course, were returning to the scene of the crime, one of the darkest days in the history of their club, the 8-0 drubbing they suffered at the Nissan Stadium last season. But talking of the history of the club, this game on Saturday night was a celebration of the 30th anniversary of Yokohama F. Marinos. And, they delighted all of their supporters with the 3 points on the evening. I guess the Tokyo supporters will have begun to get flashbacks in just the 8th minute when Takuma Nishimura headed in Katsuya Nagato's cross. And I'm sure, all Tokyo supporters are wondering if they were in for another very, very long 90 minutes at the Nissan Stadium. But it took them only 4 minutes to draw level through Shuto Abe after Diego Oliveira bullied Kota Watanabe off the ball about 45 yards from the F. Marinos goal. The F. Marinos players protested that Oliveira had fouled Watanabe in winning the ball back, and I think they did have quite a strong case there. And when the shoe was on the other foot for F. Marinos back in match day 3, they had a goal disallowed, actually, for a Nishimura challenge on Yoshinori Suzuki against Espolsa. Elber's goal was ultimately disallowed after a VAR check. The VAR did have a look here, but decided, to many people's bemusement, that Oliveira had won the ball back fairly, and that allowed Abe's goal to stand. And Sam, I think this was an important goal for FC Tokyo in general, because a problem they've had in recent years is not getting enough goals from midfield. Abe didn't score at all in the league last season. And, we can talk about how important of a win this was for F. Marinos. But just allow me this little bit of a glimmer of FC Tokyo chat this week. It was, an important goal, perhaps, for Tokyo going forward.
Yeah, it's a very important goal. I'd like to congratulate you on your debut in the VAR box, if you've allowed this to stand, because it was a dreadful decision. It's a completely clear foul when you look at the replay. I don't know why it's allowed to stand, but as with every VAR decision this weekend, it's left me baffled. But yeah, it is very good for Abe, who was, it burst onto the scene, didn't he? Had a terrific first season, not really in it last year, I don't think. But now, yeah, if he's allowed to get forward a little bit more, express himself, make those runs beyond the striker, he's a tremendous player. And yeah, it was a big one for him. It was great for Tokyo to just bounce back in the manner that they did. Yeah, it's a foul and whatnot, but the response was very good, because you could imagine this time last season, you concede inside 8 minutes against Yokohama. It could be any score, but Tokyo did battle back well, got their goal. Very dodgy, but it allowed Tokyo back into it. I thought they played quite well in that first half. Kono had a couple of chances. The one just in on goal, I just think he didn't necessarily have the confidence to go on and beat the keeper. It was a tame effort in the end. He's much better at those edge of the area curlers than the one he just hit just over the bar. But yeah, I thought it was a very good response from Tokyo, considering the history of this fixture, especially last season.
Yeah, most heavily. They probably, yeah, should have gone on to take the lead, even though that goal shouldn't have stood. Yeah, they probably should have gone into the break at least 2-1 ahead. But yeah, as you say, Kono had two good chances, and Yuto Nagatomo looked like he was through as well, but fired into the side netting. So ultimately for Tokyo, again, before we segue on and give F. Marinos their credit for this victory on a a huge occasion for their club, I guess, yeah, for Tokyo, Sam, it's just another honourable defeat, I suppose, like the opening day against Kawasaki, where they've given a good demonstration of what Albert Puig wants them to do. It's not got them any rewards at all. Again, similar to match day one, but there were positives that the supporters could take away from this performance as a whole, even though it stings to lose away at one of your local rivals.
Yeah, I'm glad you've said that, because that's how I was assessing this game and the Kawasaki one, but didn't want to come over as patronising. But you played really well, even though you've lost to the two biggest rivals. But I do think there are a lot of positives to take out from the performance as a whole. The pressing is really good. You're causing so many problems. You're turning over possession in high positions. You just a little bit more clinical nature up front, then maybe you'd get a few more goals. But considering it's been, a couple of months under Albert Pucci or Priegel or whatever, it's I think the signs are there, and it's never going to be a quick solution. And FC Tokyo is suddenly going to be challenging for the title this season. It was always going to be a bit of more of a slow progress, but you can definitely see the shoots so far. I think it was a very good performance. Yes, you've lost another game against a team that in the future you want to be competing with, you want to be beating. But yeah, I just thought, yeah, just take away. Yeah, it's no point, but it was another positive step forward.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Thank you, mate. All right. So, again, it's a defeat for Tokyo. They should have gone into the sheds with the advantage, but F. Marinos made them pay almost immediately from the restart, and it was a masterstroke from Kevin Muscat, bringing Kota Mizunuma on at half time. And in the first minute of the second half, Shuto Abe gave the ball away in midfield, and it was played out to Mizunuma on the right. His cross found Anderson Lopez, whose shot deflected in off Yasuki Kimoto, and indeed the post, and maybe even skimmed off Jakub Slovic's head as well. This was given to Lopez, and I was quite surprised to do a Google check today, and Sam, and see that it actually was credited to Lopez as well, because I wondered whether his shot was ultimately going to be flying across the face of goal before it glanced off Kimoto. But I guess it was the two players were too close a quarters for the Google machine to make a judgment on exactly whether Lopez's shot was on target or not. But that was F. Marinos back into the lead in the second minute of the second half. And not a lot happening for Tokyo. I don't know whether there was a disappointment in the fact that they didn't go on and take the lead in the first half, but yeah, they never really went that close to an equaliser in the second half, did they? And of course, they lost the golden boy, Kuryu Matsuki, to a second yellow card in the 74th minute. He'd gotten his first in the first 30 seconds of the game. One of those where usually referees will not give. They referee context, not the actual occasion, not the actual foul. So I think a lot of us were surprised to see Matzke yellow carded so early, but ultimately that was the correct decision. And Matzke didn't have any complaints at the second yellow card. And I guess that took the final lot of wind out of Tokyo sails. But for F. Marinos, a huge occasion. For them, Sam, they weren't at their free-flowing best, and a lot of that was to do with the way that Tokyo pressed them. But, ultimately a huge victory, and coming after, obviously, they knew Frontale's result from earlier on in the afternoon, and that meant that, they could close to within a point at the top with a victory, and, they've gone and done it.
Yeah, it kind of brings a different level of pressure, doesn't it, when you know that your main rivals have lost and there's a chance there to take advantage. And when it was brought back to 1-1, they might have been quite worried, especially the way that Tokyo were playing. But yeah, the way they started both halves is the way that they've won this game. They were so quick out of the traps, just caused problems initially. They were very good down that right-hand side, whether it was with Miyuchi in the first half. He obviously drew the foul from Matsuki and got him booked, but then Mizunuma came on and did very well. The cross makes the goal, I think, and Google and everyone else are just, this is what Anderson Lopez does. No shot of his is going on target, but it'll deflect it and it'll find its way there. And that's just how it is. So, yeah, well done to him for another well-earned goal. But Marinos, I thought just that quick start to the second half. It's just, because Tokyo, I think, can maybe just have to build into the game a little bit. They've caught flat-footed a few times this season, right at the start of halves or the start of the game. Marinos are a team that can, they do start their halves very quickly. They get advantages early on in those games, and this was just another occasion of that. And afterwards, there wasn't a great response necessarily from Tokyo in terms of going forward and creating chances. They were still causing issues for F. Marinos, and they weren't allowed to be quite as free-flowing as they usually are. But it's just whether you can just add a little bit more in the final third. Tokyo, I think that's just where it's missing at the moment. But as I say, it's a process that will get better. And Marinos, we've got to give them credit. The game was pretty much over when there was the red card, and I don't think a great deal happened after that. But they took their chances just about well enough, and just the way they started that half, it was what was turned out to be enough to beat FC Tokyo.
Yes, indeed. So, they capped that big occasion with the 3 points, and well done to F. Marinos. Mentioned in part one, the most surprising result of the match day was definitely Cerezo winning 4-1 at Kawasaki. Well, the most surprising team of the first six match days, I think, for most of us, have been Kashiwa Reysol. And, the good times continue to roll. And the Hitachi Dai, after Saturday's 2-0 home win over Iwata, man of the moment, Mateus Savio, netted again. Sam, he mistimed his header from Hiromu Mitsumaru's cross in the 41st minute, but things are just going for Savio these days. And even though he didn't make a great contact with the ball, it still bounced in despite a despairing dive by the wrong-footed Ryuki Miura in the Iwata net. So, it's, I don't know, everything Savio touches seems to turn to gold so far this season.
Yeah, and good for him, actually, because the last couple of seasons he's been riddled with injuries. He's never had a sustained period in the team, and he's never been able to show what apparently is his true quality, because he's been instrumental in the way that Kashiwa have played this season. And that link up with Koyamatsu in the two kind of shadow positions behind the striker, I just think those two are working so well. And even without Douglas in this game, they just get the best out of Hosoya as well. And like last season, every time we've seen Hosoya previously, he looks like a run-of-the-mill player. But this season, they brought out something in him, and he's added a few finishes to his game. His movement is a lot cleverer. And they've got that trio is really key. And Doddy, I think, coming back into midfield, and he's added a little bit of solidity, a little bit of class in that midfield. And around that, I don't know if there's necessarily a great deal of quality. It's still a team that was struggled for most of last season and seemed to have been weakened with the players that left them as well. But they're getting the best out of them, and those key players are really coming to the fore. So, yeah, full credit to them. They're playing very well. They took advantage of a terrible Jubilo team. I don't like to get on teams necessarily, but this is a really poor team. One of the worst, in my opinion, that I've seen in the league, because they're just so slow. Just physically and mentally, they don't really click into gear and know what's happening. I mean, that second goal where Toshima scores, I mean, they've got so many players back in good positions, but nobody realises that Toshima's coming in at the back. Everyone is just stood still, and that is just how Jubilo defend, just static, stuck in the mud. And it's so easy, if you just play with a little bit of pace, as Kashua did, it's so easy to break through them. And yeah, it's just terrible for Jubilo. I mean, I don't really see any signs of positivity, except for Yuto Suzuki, who apparently was still the top scorer and somehow scoring goals. But yeah, just when they play against any half-decent team, they just get walked through. And yeah, not great for them, but full credit to Kashua. You can only beat what's in front of them. And yeah, playing very well. I think getting the best out of players that have dreadfully underperformed in the last few seasons, and just got that few quality players that are really playing well.
Yeah, terrific stuff. As we've said throughout the first six weeks of the season, yeah, most of us had them down in the bottom three in our J-Preds, but they're within touching distance of the top three after six match days. Just 2 points behind both F. Marinos and Kashima, and indeed just 3 points behind the leaders, Frontale, having played two games fewer. And Savio and Sachiro Toshima, who again looks about 15 years old and always got his shirt neatly tucked into his shorts, and his shorts pulled up around his belly button. He certainly doesn't look like a professional footballer, but he certainly can play like one. A terrific little player, and an excellent volley to ultimately seal the points for Reysol in the 52nd minute. And Sam, you mentioned Mal Hosoya there. He was denied some icing on the cake in the 83rd minute by a fingertip save from Miura, and I guess you've got a feel for him, don't you? He's looks to be a pretty decent shot stopper, but not a lot happening in front of him. Just before we move off Reysol then, you've talked about how slow and ponderous Iwata are. Reysol defensively though, should we take away the fact that they've only conceded three goals from their six games? Is that a lot to do with the teams they've played so far, or are there definite strides that they've made defensively to tighten up in the first six match days that you've noticed?
They are tighter. I mean, there are caveats here. They played Shonan, 10 men of Shonan. I mean, Shonan aren't scoring with 11 men, let alone 10. And then Marinos, the most free-flowing of teams that they played against, were with 9 men. So there are issues there. But against Kashima... against Kashima, who are a free-flowing team and are scoring a lot of goals, they were a lot tighter. I think a lot of it comes down to Kim Sung-gyu, because on his day, he is potentially one of the best goalkeepers in the league, but he's a Korean national goalkeeper, probably starts for them at the World Cup. So you think with him, you've got a real good base, but last couple of seasons, he's not really been with it. I think Alan putting him in his team of the J-League went to his head a bit, and he forgot how to play football after that. But otherwise, you've got Koga, who I've always liked, and he's always been like on his own, I think, in terms of the defensive part of this team. But they've brought in Ominami, who's come in a little bit more, and Yuji Takahashi, who was injured for a lot of last season, but he's got more experience there. So they've just been settled, which I think is the key part of it. And then you've got, they've settled on their formation as well, the 3-6-1/4-6-3-4-3, but it's almost always the same team with Mitsumaro as the left wing back. There's a little bit of a change at right wing back, but Nakamura is doing pretty well. So that just allowing that team to settle. Like previously, I mean, they've had so many centre backs play in those positions. Kamijima played for a lot last season. They brought in Emerson Santos, who was terrible, and he's still not knocking about somewhere, but they're not brought him in there. So, and Somaya has also played a lot. They always chopped and changed at right wing back with Kawaguchi and Kitazume and Takahashi, and all these players But thankfully, Nelsinho has just found a team, settled it, and that is really helping them. I think we still have to wait a few more games into the season. I think it's a real good test tomorrow or today as this podcast goes out against a free-flowing Cerezo Osaka team who have got their tails up. And that'll be a real interesting one to see how they cope with that because, yeah, I think fixtures have been slightly favourable to Racehall so far, but I mean, it does. There are really positive signs, so hopefully for them that can keep continue.
Yes, indeed. It's been a surprising start, but yet they're well and truly fourth on merit after 6 match days at Kashiwa, and yet fair play to them, fourth from the top, while their opponents are Iwata, fourth from the bottom after match day 6. The other winners in the sixth round of the season were Hiroshima, who won the battle of the bottom away at Shonan Bellmare. These two teams entered in the bottom two, and Bellmare remain anchored to the foot of the table after this 1-0 defeat that was sealed by impressive youngster Makoto Mitsuta, who arrived to stroke home a tremendous first time finish past Kosei Tani from Tomoya Fuji's across the box. And, it was just another one of those days, Sam, where nothing went right for Shonan in front of goal. They're somewhat fortunate in the fact that they haven't been cut adrift yet. But, they're not really offering too many signs that they'll be seriously challenging to get out of the bottom three all season. But, I think we'd spoken in the past couple of past couple of match days about Hiroshima and their improved performances under Michael Skibber. I don't know if they pulled up too many trees here in Hiratsuka Central Park, but definitely an important victory, and it pushed them up 3 spots in the table up to 13th.
Yeah, very important victory. It was a terrible game. It was awful, I think. And you picked it out as the game of the week because it's got an intrigue there last week, but yeah, it was just awful. But Hiroshima took advantage of... They were the better team, but Shonan were without another 8 players with COVID. I mean, if you take out their players, Nagaki was missing, Okamoto, Sagawa, Sugioka, Machino, Wellington, like, so many of their key players were missing. And they're not a very good team with all of them there. And take out all of them, I mean, they had no chance, really. I can't remember them going forward very often, if at all. And Hiroshima were very very comfortable in the game. They didn't really create too much because they've still got their issues going forward. Rio Nagai is not a J1 striker, but he's leading the line for them. So, yeah, there was 2 teams with major issues. Hiroshima, thankfully for them, didn't have as many issues on this day with the COVID stuff. They looked the better team. They have played pretty well. I think they've been getting better as the season has gone on. But and took the goal is fantastic, I think, the technique from Mitsuta. And he's been one of the big positives from since Michael Skibber has come into the country. He's got a lot more game time. So there are signs that it's going okay for Hiroshima, but I don't know how much I could take from a victory over Shonan's reserve team, and their first team is just awful. And I'm very disappointed that I didn't put them in my bottom three. It's looking like a terrible error this time. The first season ever, I haven't put Shonan to go down.
Yeah, it's not looking great for Bellmare, is it? And apologies to Hiroshima. I sold them a spot short. Of course, they rose 4 spots in the table, not 3, from 17th up to 13th after this their first victory of the new season. And yes, the first under Michael Skibber. So well done to Hiroshima. And we'll all try and erase this game from our memories as quickly as possible. All right, so 2 games left to go. And we've briefly talked about some of the major talking points from one of them up at the Sapporo Dome on Saturday night. Sapporo hosted Urawa and the game finished 1-1. David Moberg, who is just loving life after finally being able to play in the J-League, scored for the second straight game. And yes, the Reds' goal came from the penalty spot, as we mentioned earlier in part one. After that, a penalty was given against Akito Fukumori. Then, of course, Sapporo were denied their penalty 7 minutes after Reds had taken the lead. And just before the end of the first half, Takanori Sugino kept Sapporo in the game with a superb reflex save to keep out Kasper Juncker's shot. Then Takuro Kaneko equalised from close range for Sapporo in the 72nd minute with an improvised finish as he was falling to the floor. And then potentially a huge moment in the game with 13 minutes left, Sam, when Takuma Arano, the Sapporo midfielder, was sent off after a VAR check had determined and, well, brought to the referee's attention that he had raked his studs down the back of Yusuke Matsuo's calf. The red sub on for his first appearance for Urawa since joining from Yokohama FC. And, of course, one of our favourites. Arano, surely he can't be doing that to Matsuo, surely.
No, I think that should be a 10-game ban, I think, just for touching Matsuo, getting even close to him. It's a terrible tackle. And he's got a previous for this, Arano. I mean, there is no way he's getting the ball here. It's just there to take out Matsuo. I can't think about what else he's thinking. Just the studs down the back of the calf. Really poor challenge. And, yeah, no complaints. Well, they shouldn't be having any complaints, Sapporo. They had plenty in this game. As I said earlier, they were furious with everything. The world was conspiring against them, but not with this one. Arano definitely deserved to be sent off. It was a really poor challenge. And, as I said earlier, I thought the Sapporo penalty that wasn't, I thought it was a correct decision. And looking closely at the Kaneko goal as well, I think he's offside as they play it in. So there, I think the world's against them. I'm sort of the opinion that they got a little bit fortunate with that decision there. But it was a really weird and tetchy and furious game. Everyone was so angry by the end of it. I think it ended at the 103rd minute after all there were injuries. There was complaints. There was Misha Petrovic looking like he might go and punch a few people when towards the end of it. It was a really weird game. But yeah, I mean, it's six straight draws as well for Sapporo. Is that must be close to a record, at least to start the season, if not in general play. So it was just a weird, weird game, this one.
Yeah, I think we can call that, Sam. If anybody wants to fact check us and pick us up on it, then they're more than welcome to. But yeah, six draws to begin a J1 season, that has to be a new record for Sapporo. So I don't know. Well done, guys. Well, not really, but yeah, I suppose they haven't lost yet. They're one of only two teams yet to lose, and we'll come on to the other in the ninth and final game that we'll cover from match day six. But Sapporo usually entertain you and when you have to wake up early to begin your J1 match day, Sam. On this occasion, they were, of course, concluding it alongside F. Marinos and Tokyo in the late game on Saturday. But it was quite a heated occasion at the Sapporo Dome on Saturday night, no question. And for Reds, I guess, they've left frustrated after, not only the final 13 minutes of the 90 playing with a man advantage. But as you say, yeah, there were 13 minutes of stoppage time as well. So, when you add it up, it's over 25 minutes playing 11 against 10. And, Ataru Esaka almost nicked all 3 points right at the death with literally the last kick of the game. But his volley flashed inches wide of the far post, Sugino's left-hand post. And, so both teams ultimately had to settle for a point, as did both teams in the game that opened the match day on Friday night at the Best Denki Stadium. It was a Kyushu derby between Fukuoka and, yes, the other team yet to lose this season, Sagan Tosu, who have done a decent job of matching Sapporo's record of six draws to begin the season, but, of course, are a couple of points better off after one win and five draws to begin the season. But yeah, it's a pretty it's a sorry tale in terms of the goals for column, Sam, for Tosu. Only three scored from six games, but yes, they do have the best defense in terms of goals allowed thus far, just a two conceded. And another clean sheet for Tosu away on Friday night, although Fukuoka could feel slightly hard done to here after they had the ball in the net in the 69th minute through Shun Nakamura. He thought he'd scored his first J1 goal, but was a fraction offside when Lukian's bundled shot left his boot. But it did take a 4-minute VAR delay to confirm that, Sam. So, Fukuoka, it was, an emotional roller coaster, I'm sure, for Nakamura. And, why did it take so long? It looked to me like Lukian's tried to shoot there, and it has deflected off a defender. But yeah, his shot has come with Nakamura in an offside position.
Well, I don't think it helped. I don't know if they see the exact same replays that we do on the television, but they only showed it from one angle, and you couldn't 100% be certain who got the ball first. Like, if Lukian does get the shot away and then it's deflected into Nakamura, then he's definitely offside and there's no complaints. But if it's just a tackle and Lukian doesn't quite get contact on the shot, then it should be allowed to continue to Nakamura. So I can only assume that it has been hit by Lukian, and then they've come to the correct decision. But yeah, I don't know. It was taking absolutely forever. Maybe they thought, okay, this goal does count, but Lukian's involved, and we can't allow Lukian to be anywhere near a goal the way he's going this season. So maybe that's why it was disallowed. But yeah, it's, at least they got the decision right, I think. I think that's the one crumb of comfort we can take from a VAR call this week, because the rest of it has been dreadful. So yeah, well done to the officials, I suppose. And yeah, it's a shame for Abispa. I thought just about the better team. I don't think there were too many clear-cut chances in the game. Maybe they just about shaded it, but yeah, it was just kind of a game besides that moment. It kind of had nil-nil written all over it. And midweek we've got Sagantos versus Consadole Sapporo, so I don't give out betting advice, but I think there's a result there you might want to look at.
yeah, all signs are pointing to that so far, definitely through the first six match days. So yeah, famous last words, of course, when we make predictions. But you'd be putting as much money as you possibly could on a draw, I would say. But again, please bet responsibly. Fukuoka then. Sam, I guess for them, yeah, Jordi Crooks has really developed into the key attacking player for them, hasn't he? He was at the centre of, pretty much everything for them from the highlights. Anyway, his free kick almost caught to Park Il-gyu out just before halftime. And then, a set piece from Crooks was headed just past the post by Douglas Grolley with about 15 minutes to go. So, it's not happening for Lukian, but it's not for a want of trying from Jordi Crooks.
No, I always liked him last season, but for whatever reason, he was generally on the bench and not given too many starts. But yeah, he always looks dangerous when he cuts in on his left foot. He scored so many goals, either with a cut in and then a shot into the top corner, or some of those crosses where they just go into that kind of corridor of uncertainty and everyone misses it and it nestles in there. And he's, yeah, always a threat at the moment. And yeah, Lukian is definitely getting the service. And as I've said before, I'm sure it'll eventually go for him and he'll eventually get on the end of something and score, and then Avispa might be away. Because this was another game I thought Avispa were the better side, but haven't quite got the rewards out of it that they would have liked. But yeah, another positive performance from Avispa. I think this was a slightly weaker performance than we've been seeing from Tozer. Yes, goals are an issue going forward, but generally speaking, their play has been quite good. This one, I don't think they executed it quite as well as previously. I don't know how big a derby this necessarily is, because there seems to be 1,000 Kyushu derbies, so I'm not sure which one to rank in any order. But maybe the derby feel kind of disjointed the game a little bit. But yeah, it was not quite as bad as Hiroshima and Shonan, but not one I'll watch again.
No, fair enough. Well, yeah, I mean, for Lukian, he just might need one to bounce in off his ass or something against Kashima on Wednesday night, and then he'll be away. We'll wait and see. But poor fella coming off a golden boot in J2, and nothing's gone for him yet. And
he needs a training session with Anderson Lopez.
There you go. Exactly. That's right. Yes. Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't link up with him during the international break for some tips. But we'll wait and see there for Lukian. But he's working his guts out. It's just not happening for him yet. All right. So that's the match day six covered. A couple of match days to look ahead to in the coming days. As we've mentioned in passing a couple of times, match day seven will be played this Wednesday. And hands up if you had Cerezo Osaka versus Kashiwa as your match of the round heading into this season. Well, I'm pretty sure nobody's got their hands up at the moment, but these two teams find themselves in fifth and fourth respectively. And without question, it is the pick of the match day seven fixtures. Both are obviously coming off victories and, yes, riding high inside the top six. We've got another Kansai Derby on the slate with Kyoto hosting Gunma Osaka. Again, those two teams are next to each other in the table. Sanga are 10th and Gunma 9th. And we've mentioned with with Alan Kobe head to FC Tokyo, still looking for their first victory of the season. Tokyo will have to make do without Kuroyu Matsuki for the first time in the league this season, while the top three are all away against bottom half opposition on Wednesday night. Again, you wouldn't want to be Jubilo Iwata when the champions Kawasaki come calling. And yeah, with their heads are still ringing, I'm sure, from the blasting that their manager gave them after that 4-1 home defeat against Cerezo on Saturday. Yokohama F. Marino's visit Hiroshima and Kashima, travel down to Kyushu to face Fukuoka. And yeah, whether Lukian can get off the snide or not, we'll wait and see. So, Sam, yeah, a terrific looking set of fixtures on Wednesday night.
Yeah, really interested. I don't think there's necessarily a game that I'm not looking forward to there. I mean, Cerezo Kashima is getting his own pedestal on the Tuesday night and should be a really exciting game, two teams in form. But yeah, looking up and down those fixtures, they all look interesting. Even Shonan against Nagoya, because just I have it in my head that Shonan get results against Nagoya. And Nagoya's it's not really going well for them so far this season after that first game. They're in dire need of a result, as are Shonan. And yeah, historically, they've done well against Nagoya and they relegated them back in the day. So, yeah, maybe Shonan can get 3 points there. I mean, it won't be the greatest game, I don't think, but it's the one that I've got a lot of interest in. And I think Tokyo Kobe as well. I mean, is this kind of the first ACL team or the first quote-unquote big team that Tokyo can go out and get a result under Albert Pucci this season? And it's a real big one for Kobe. I know, but okay, maybe they're not focused on it. Maybe they're looking at something else down the road. But, I mean, they could be bottom of the table at the end of the week. So things have to start for Kobe. And, yeah, it's just such a crucial game because if they lose this one, they've got Cerezo at the weekend. If they find themselves second bottom or bottom going into the ACL and the games that will be taken place while they're down there, they could get themselves cut adrift. And I mean, it's what an interesting position that would be if we find Vissel Kobe cut adrift at the bottom of the table when they return from the ACL.
Yeah, most definitely. And thanks for pulling me up there. Of course, yes, Cerezo Kashima is the only game on Tuesday night. So, yes, it's out on its own and it's the stand-up fixture from the entire match day. So, yeah, that's quite appropriate that, yeah, it takes place by itself on the Tuesday at 7 o'clock. And then match day 8, well, I'm all over this, Sam. There's only one game on the Saturday, right? It's a potentially a huge one at 7 o'clock. And again, Kashima are involved as they travel to the defending champions Kawasaki Frontale. And then on Sunday, Kobe face Cerezo Osaka, as we mentioned, in another Kansai Derby. But for me, and I'm sure for you as well, the standout is Kashima hosting Yokohama F. Marinos. A terrific game in any season, but one of them could be going top of the table if there's any slip up from Frontale in the next two match days.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, they could well be, especially against Reysol for Frontale. But yeah, this game, under any circumstances, Kashima versus Yokohama is usually a really good game. I think it was like a 5-3 last season. And Kashima are just set up to attack this year. I think Marinos, they've had to deal with their squad a little bit. They've still got lots of injuries. And maybe Antlers can take advantage of that or some tiredness. And I just think it'll be a really exciting game. Both teams will go for it. I expect loads of goals in this game. And yeah, it's a really exciting one. And it may even take my eye off Shonan versus Jubilo, which is happening at the same time. I think one might attract my attention a little more than the other.
Yes, I reckon so. I reckon so. All right. Well, yes. And anything for our patrons to look forward to perhaps on late on Wednesday evening, Sam?
Well, I will give it a go. We've got eight games happening at the same time pretty much on Wednesday, but I will try my best to be all over them and get a report out sometime that evening. I'll be as quick as I can, but what's it, last game finish run? Oh, I don't know what time that is. Your time,
half nine.
Is it your time? Half nine, okay. So, yeah, by midnight, let's say, I should be able to get something out.
All right. Well, I know our patrons always look forward to your midweek matchday reviews and always entertaining reading for our patrons. All right. So that's it for our matchday six episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Alan Gibson very much for his time in part one. We'd like to thank Graham Freche for his question on Grampus. There was also one from Graham Freche on Kashiwa, but hopefully we've kind of covered your question, Graham Freche, in our chat about Resol and their impressive start to the season. Graham Freche is a patron of the J-Talk podcast. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod, just like Pat, our newest patron, did in the past week or so. So thanks very much to Pat for coming on board and to all of our patrons for their ongoing support. Listeners, it goes without saying, we'd also like to thank you for listening wherever you are. So we'll be back with Sam's midweek review on Wednesday night, and then next week, a full review of the Matchday 8 fixtures. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.